This Northeast Roadshow screencast is going to take us across a number of areas of the core .NET framework. You'll hear things you already know you knew at one point, and things you didn't know you didn't know. How's that for clear? Let me couch this presentation in a short parable, the parable of the pot roast. It goes something like this. A newlywed couple is spending their first evening in their new home, so the bride is busy making their first home-cooked meal together, a pot roast. As her husband is watching her, he notices that she's sliced the ends of the roast off before putting it in the roasting pan. Puzzled, he asks why. She responds that she's not actually quite sure, but thinks it makes it more tender, and besides, that's the way her mother always made it. A few weeks pass, and the new couple goes over to the bride's parents' house for a family dinner. Sure enough, it's pot roast, and as the family is gathered around the table, the son-in-law asks his bride's mother why she cut off the ends of the roast. Well, she says, it seems to make the meat tender, and that's the way my mother always made it. At that point, from the end of the table, came a comment from Grandma. Yes, dear, but I cut off the ends of the roast so it would fit in the only pan I had. So what's that got to do with software development? Well, the point of the story is that we often do things because we're modeling how we've seen others do them. We inherit code that perhaps implements a certain design pattern or anti-pattern and subsume it into our own repertoire. Some of us as well come from different programming backgrounds and bring forth techniques that may or may not be relevant when programming on the .NET platform. So for this session, we're going to explore a number of those items. For some of you, this may be old hat. For others, you may pick up a new thing or two, and perhaps even have your own aha moment. I'm going to start off with a discussion of reference versus value types, which will lead into a couple of directions as we progress through the presentation. As you sit down to blast out some code to model your domain, at one point or another, you need to make a decision as to how a specific entity in your domain will be treated. Will it be a reference type or a value type? Namely, a class, something that extends system.object, or a structure, which extends system.value type. Despite the contention by some that structures are light classes, they really share many of the same capabilities. They can each have fields, properties, and methods, as well as implement interfaces. One major area where they differ, though, is extensibility. A structure is, in effect, sealed. If, for instance, you wanted to model a whole number type, it seems logical to extend the system.in32 type, but you can't because it's a value type and not extensible. So if you opt for a structure, you better be very sure it's not something you'll want to refine later by way of inheritance. The one differentiator that most people point to is storage. Reference types are always allocated on the heap, which is just managed memory bounded more or less by the available RAM on your machine. Each reference type has a bit of overhead though, a type pointer and a sync pointer used for locking semantics. Managing the heap is expensive. To clean up object references, a garbage collection thread is recurrently walking through all of the objects, marking the inaccessible ones, freeing them up, and then perhaps compacting the heap when it starts getting fragmented. All that takes time and CPU cycles. Value types are allocated on the stack or in line on the heap, meaning they don't force another reference to be created. The stack is a constrained resource with a maximum size per thread, but it's an efficient one. The .NET framework doesn't garbage collect the stack per se. It simply moves the stack pointer, and so data isn't actually deleted, it's just no longer referenceable. Somewhat related with the storage scheme are the semantics for assignment. When you assign one reference type to another, you simply create a new pointer to the original object. The amount of data assigned here is always 4 to 8 bytes, depending on whether you're running 32-bit or 64-bit applications. For value types, the assignment copies the fields of the entire structure, so now you have two independent pieces of memory and the amount of storage has doubled. In terms of equality, with reference types it's really an identity operation. Two reference types are equal if they point to the very same object on the heap. For a value type, two instances are equal if the values of each of the internal fields are equal, even though they are two distinct objects in memory. So that highlights the differences, and there are pros and cons to both sides. So which do you use? Your default should be to use a reference type, unless all of the following criteria are met, in which case consider a value type. First, the type should behave like a primitive type. Essentially, it should capture data and not behavior. An address, for instance, has multiple fields, but really doesn't have behavior, so it's a reasonable candidate. Of course, you'll want to make sure again that you will never need to extend that type via inheritance, because you can't. Lastly, you should aim to make the value type simple and atomic, and also strive to make it immutable. We'll talk more about immutability later, so let's just table that point for a moment. Structure instances should be small, and 16 bytes is a rough guideline. Why small? Well, think about the copy semantics. Every time you pass a structure or assign a value type variable, you're copying data. If you have a structure that's 1,000 bytes and pass it back and forth as a parameter, you're incurring a performance penalty for all the copies that are being made internally. Instances should also be short-lived, because generally they'll live on the stack, and again the stack is a constrained resource. In the name of scalability and performance, you don't want anything lingering there longer than required. Presuming you get to the end of the checklist and decide, yep, I need a structure here, consider also the following 2 points. Although the equality semantics work, remember value types are checked for equality by comparing each internal property, it's very slow. The default process uses reflection, and you can always do a more efficient job explicitly. Best practices recommend you override the equals method yourself. Then that will lead you to override the getHashCode method as well. And since you've overridden equals, you'll want to provide an implementation for the equality operator and the inequality operator too. Nothing that's rocket science, but something you need to do to provide the best performance for people using your structure. Secondly, realize that you cannot hide the default constructor for a structure. With a class, if you wanted to make sure consumers of your class are always using a parameterized constructor, you can make the default constructor private. You can't do that for structures, so there will always be a way for someone to create a default version of your structure. If a structure with all zeros or empty strings is not valid in your domain, you'll have some additional validation work to do within any of your code that interacts with instances of that structure. Now let's return to that topic of mutability that I mentioned earlier. Here's a reasonable candidate for a structure or value type. It's small and encapsulates what we consider an atomic set of data. Below the declaration is a small snippet of the code to access the structure and assign some values. Now the definition of the structure is pretty simple here, and a more robust version would do some bounds checking on the latitude and longitude values to ensure they are within the allowable range. So presuming that was in place, what happens when there's an exception in setting the longitude here? Well, you'd hopefully have some exception handling code to deal with it, and then perhaps reset the value to something legal, but you still have a location instance in some inconsistent or unknown state. Bottom line, that's additional code to handle contingencies from a simple property setting. And what happens if there are multiple threads accessing an object? In this code, values are being set to constants, so it's not an issue here. But in the general case, it's possible that multiple threads access different parts of the instance, potentially resulting in an inconsistent object. That's solvable as well with locking and synchronization mechanisms, but again, more code, more testing, and more potential points of failure. That's where immutability comes in. Here's an alternative implementation of the same structure, but the properties are now read-only, and the only way to set the component properties is via a constructor. Now, to modify the value of a location object, we simply create a new one with the values needed. The constructor is going to run on a single thread, and if there's an exception, well, the object just doesn't get created. Worst case, the location result is a null reference, but not an object that's partially set with a valid latitude but invalid longitude, for instance. So how do you embrace immutability as part of your development style? As we saw from the previous example, favor read-only members, where assignment can occur only in the constructor, and conversely avoid property setters. Be aware too that other constructs implicitly provide immutability. With Link in .NET 3.5, for instance, immutable classes are created whenever there's an anonymous class within a link query. And in .NET 4.0, the story gets a bit better. Anonymous classes in .NET 3.5 can only be used within the scope of the module they are created. They don't have an explicit type, and you can't pass a var as a parameter. The tuple generic class in .NET 4, though, lets you build similar classes on the fly, but provides a non-anonymous type, enabling you to move them around more nimbly in your code. We all deal with immutables on a daily basis, since the string is an immutable class. It's also a reference type versus a value type, so it's stored on the heap and managed by the garbage collector. Let's take a look at some scenarios involving the uses of string. Here's a simple formatting routine that takes components of a person's name and creates an output string of the format last name, suffix, first name, and then middle initial. Since string is immutable, every line of code that includes an assignment to full name results in a new string, an object on the heap being created, and the old one is discarded. The old one is now subject to garbage collection, so it's another object for the collector to have to manage as well. Many .NET developers will look at this code in bulk, specifically because of the overhead of string immutability, and prefer instead code like this, which leverages the String Builder class. String Builder is a mutable type, essentially a buffer of some length into which individual strings are stuffed via the append method. If there's no more room in the buffer, String Builder will handle that automatically and allocate a new buffer double the current size. At that point, of course, there's the heap overhead, but if the original buffer length is well thought out, the reallocations can be minimized. So let's see how much these techniques differ. I set up a simple testing scenario. I have an array of 10,000 strings of length 5 to 15 characters, representative of people's first and last names. The test harness calls the formatter methods we just looked at for each of these 10,000 names, and then encloses that outer loop in another 1,000 iterations. So it's building 10 million names altogether. Here's what resulted. You might be surprised that the string concatenation approach was faster and used the least amount of memory. String Builder used over 60% more memory. Even when optimized not to require a reallocation, it still couldn't beat the standard string concatenation. So obviously all the press about String Builder being better is just hype, right? Or is it? Let's examine another scenario using that same list of 10,000 strings. This time the code is concatenating the segments into one huge string. Here it's an apples and oranges comparison because the string concatenation sample didn't even complete. For just 10 iterations it was churning for minutes and consumed almost 10 gig of RAM, including a large number of very expensive Generation 2 garbage collections. So obviously String Builder is better, here at least. So what is the verdict? As with many of these trade-off type questions, the answer is, it depends. In his blog, Rico Mariani counsels that there is no one answer, and it depends on the usage pattern. If you have code that looks something like this, where you do some calculations, add a bit to the string, do some more calculations, add more to the string, and so on, then consider using String Builder. But if you have code that does just a straight assignment, perhaps a simple string concatenation is a better approach. Bottom line, decide based on your own observations and testing, and not on some absolute edict. Keep in mind, too, that in cases like client applications, the effects may be negligible. Does it really matter that one executes 10 milliseconds faster? In a server environment, though, where a WCF service, for instance, may be pegged by thousands of hits, the economies of scale kick in, and you may need to squeeze every ounce of performance out of your code that you can. Now, how did I get these results? There's an awesome utility called CLR Profiler that you can access from the URL here. I've shortened it here, but it leads to an MSDN download. It has a rather unremarkable user interface, simply an option to start profiling an application for memory allocations and/or method invocations. What results, though, are dozens of reports and graphs detailing how much memory is allocated, how many garbage collections were performed, where various types are stored on the heap, how long they've been stored there, and much more. There's a 100-plus page document to explain it all, as well as provide guidance on how to tackle specific performance investigations. It's not something you'll jump to as your first reaction to slow code, but it's an awesome resource when you need it. Now getting back to our value reference discussion. What happens when these two types, which we have seen have radically different semantics, meet? Here's a small snippet of code. It's somewhat dated, and there are better implementations as we'll see shortly, but back in the .NET 1.1 days, this was the standard approach for dealing with a dynamically sized array. Let's walk through the code. At the line here, we've got an array list reference on the heap already. Next, the value type 1, a constant, gets pushed onto the stack. We now get to the add method, which needs to open up another reference on the heap. At this point, it would be great to store the 1 in that new slot on the heap, but look at the IntelliSense for the add method. It expects an object type, not a value type, and 1 is a value type. So what happens next is that a new object is created on the heap, and then the value type is copied into it, in an operation known as boxing. Execution then progresses to the next line, where num is allocated on the stack, and the value type is extracted from the object type on the heap, unboxing. As we did with the string scenario, let's take a look at some of the stats for the sample code. Here code is processing a million integers, just successively adding them to an array list and then pulling them out into a local variable. Execution time is about an eighth of a second, whatever that means in relative terms. But note that there's over 32 meg of memory being used. The code is storing 1 million integers of 4 bytes each, so that's a considerable overhead. Overhead attributed to the type and sync pointer present in every object instance. .NET 2.0 gave us generics, and with the list generic type, we gain not only type safety, but also the benefit of a true list of values versus a list of reference types that contain values. When this code executes, the time is cut by a factor of 10, and the amount of memory used reflects the actual size of the data being stored. To better demonstrate that these differences are due to boxing, the .NET Intermediate Language, or IL, disassembler utility is a great tool. Remember that C# and Visual Basic are just syntactic sugar, so by looking at the IL they generate, you can really see what's happening under the covers. Here I've cut and pasted the IL generated for these two code snippets. It looks a bit scary at first, but it's not too hard to get the gist of it. NewObj is the new operation. STLoc means to store something from the stack in a location. LDLoc means to load it from a location back onto the stack, and so on. Line by line, these two are nearly identical, save the use of the box and unbox statements, demonstrating the effect that boxing can have on your application. The performance penalty of boxing also helps explain what I used to think was a massive redundancy in the .NET framework methods. Notice how many overloads there are for StringBuilder.append? Console.WriteLine is similar. But this one accepting an object should be enough, right? Well, technically yes, but when you pass an integer or other value type, it would incur boxing, And so for performance reasons, the designers of this type opted to create explicit overloads. You might want to do the same thing for APIs that you're exposing in your classes. By the way, some boxing scenarios are much subtler than the example we went through. Structures, for instance, can implement interfaces. And if you cast a value type implicitly or explicitly to an interface that it implements, you've just boxed it. There are some syntax analysis tools that can help identify boxing scenarios in your code. And John Robbins wrote a great MSDN magazine article a few years ago about how to create a custom rule in FXCOP to do this detection for you. There are a few additional constructs I introduced during the discussion of value versus reference that I'd like to chat about as well. When explaining immutable types, I mentioned the use of read-only. Read-only is an almost constant, being settable only in the constructor, but there's more to it than that. Consider this scenario. A third party created a specialized assembly, and it has a method to list all of the planets. They decided to use a constant to store the number of planets as part of their implementation. Consumers of that assembly might write code such as this to march through the array and process the planet list. About a year or so ago, though, Pluto was demoted, and now there's only 8 planets. No problem for the astronomy DLL vendor, just change the constant to 8, remove the last assignment to the planet list, and ship the updated assembly to customers. So what happens when the new assembly is deployed to all the end users of one of many.exe? Boom! The application will crash, because when one of many.exe was compiled against version 1 of astronomy DLL, the constant 9 was essentially compiled directly into the IL for the main application. When the loop tries to access the 9th item of planet list, it won't be there. The only recourse is to recompile the entire application and send all of it, not just the updated astronomy.dll to the end users. Had the implementers used a read-only variable instead of a constant, this wouldn't have been necessary, and the fix to astronomy.dll would have worked just fine without recompiling one of many.exe. In the location structure we looked at earlier, we discussed what might happen if an exception were thrown in the constructor. Is it even a good idea to throw an exception in the constructor? Doesn't that mean that the object is in an odd state, partially there, partially not? Well, guess what? It depends. For an instance constructor, it's okay to do, but the object will still exist from the perspective of the CLR. It's not accessible by your application, of course, but since it's on the heap, you do need to make sure that, for instance, finalizer code will run correctly, and that any unmanaged resources that may have been allocated in the constructor, but prior to the exception, are being correctly disposed, or you'll have introduced a resource leak. Additionally, you need to be careful that you haven't assigned the this pointer within that constructor to some other object, since this will not be accessible once the exception occurs. For a static or type constructor, it's a different story. A static constructor is guaranteed to execute only once, before any instance constructors for that type. If there's an exception in the static constructor, there's no chance of creating any instances of that type for the duration of your application. The type is rendered useless. While we're on the subject of exceptions, there's the contention that exceptions are expensive in terms of execution, and perhaps should be avoided. Deciding what should and shouldn't be an exception is part art and part science. Certainly, if an exception is being triggered even 50% of the time, it's probably not an exceptional condition. In some cases, you may want to opt for a try-parse pattern, such as some of the intrinsic types like int32 offer. You try to perform an operation, and if it succeeds, the function returns true, and the desired value is available as an output parameter. If it fails, the function returns false, but no exception is triggered. During the discussion on boxing, I used the generic list type introduced in .NET 2.0. In general, you should avoid using the list type in your public interfaces. Here's why. List was designed as an internal type, focused on performance. None of its methods are virtual, so you can't override, say, what happens when you insert an element in a list. There are also a few public general purpose methods like binary search. Does your collection need that functionality, or are you exposing methods unnecessarily on your own classes? Instead, make use of the generic collection types in system.collections.objectModel. There are specialized collections for read-only lists, dictionary-type lists, and observable collections, which are especially useful in data binding scenarios with WPF and Silverlight. Use list within your own internal code, and then when you're ready to return the list as part of a public interface, wrap it in a collection. It's a constant cost operation, regardless of how large the list is. For the last tidbit here, let's revisit our friend the string. Here are two string values. Look closely. The second uses the AE ligature character. Are these two strings equal or not? Well, it depends. If you're using the default equals method or the equality operator, they aren't equal. But if you're using the default compare to or string.compare methods, they are. Why is that? Equals by default performs an ordinal comparison, so it's a character by character comparison, and the AE ligature is not the same Unicode character as the letter A. Compare to, though, performs a culture sensitive comparison, and in the English culture, the AE ligature gets expanded to an A followed by an E, hence the equality. The intent, though, is not explicit in the default methods, and so many recommend using the overloaded methods and passing in the string comparison type flag to be more explicit. Certainly, if some developers are using equals and others are using compare to, the resulting code may be susceptible to very subtle bugs. I'm going to leave you with a few resources here as additional food for thought. Everything we've discussed is obviously documented in MSDN, somewhere, if you look hard and long enough. The books here are helpful in that they bring to light subtleties and best practices that are otherwise not readily apparent in the .NET framework documentation. CLR via C# in particular is a must-read for any .NET developer. Even if you are a Visual Basic developer, don't let the C# part of the title dissuade you. The book is a treasure trove of how the CLR works under the covers, garbage collection, string handling, typing, and so on. Also keep in mind that CLR 2, which the book addresses, is the same CLR version used through .NET 3.5. If you're building your own framework or classes for general consumption within your organization or publicly, the framework design guidelines should be on your shelf as well. Bill Wagner's Effective C# and More Effective C# each tackle 50 developer topics, usually in a few pages or less each, making it a great resource for finding recommended ways to implement a particular facet of your application, or perhaps for resolving an argument between you and a coworker on the right way to code something. In C# In Depth, John Skeet provides some great insight into how the language has evolved. Such insight gives you a better appreciation for the why versus the what and the how. Lastly, O'Reilly's .NET Gotchas was the inspiration for this session. It's rather dated at this point, and some of the gotchas are no longer relevant given the advances in C# 2.0 and beyond, but there are definitely still some nuggets in there. That brings us to the end of this screencast. As always, thanks for watching, and have a great day.